Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Hello and welcome to the Beyond Brunel podcast, inspired of course by Isambard Kingdom Brunel, one of the region's most famous engineers. Today we're talking about energy infrastructure and the net zero revolution. I'm joined by Becky Fowle, energy market analyst at Region. Hi Becky.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And I'm also joined by Linda Irwin, project manager at the Southwest Net Zero Hub and Southwest Infrastructure Energy Market Sector Advisor. Hi Linda.
Hello Chris.
Very nice of you to join us. And online, of course, we've got Peter Kidd. Peter is a strategic advisor to WSP and the immediate past chair of the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, or as we like to call it, SWIP. Hi Peter.
Hi Chris, and hi also to my fellow guests. Sorry I can't be with you in the studio.
And welcome to all of my guests. It's a real pleasure to have you here. Let's start with a big question. Is the Southwest ready for the net zero energy transition? Peter, perhaps you could start us off.
Well, I think the Southwest would love to be ready for the net zero transition. Whether it is or not, though, I think is the big issue. There's a major problem I think we have with connectivity to the grid. We also have a block on onshore wind farms at the moment, which is looking like it may be overcomable. And certainly there is one example in Bristol where we've got a very large on-land wind turbine being built, 4.5 megawatts. I think it's the biggest in England. But that's the exception at the moment rather than the rule. There are also other major challenges, such as putting in the infrastructure for electric vehicle charging. And it, of course, that is a bigger problem in the Southwest with its sort of mainly rural activity along the peninsula, exacerbated in the summer by the hordes of tourists that come in. And we don't have that much generation capacity in the Southwest. We've got Hinkley Point C being built, but most of the generation facilities in the Southwest are relatively small scale and primarily sort of wind and solar. And we have a huge amount of resource in the Southwest, it should be said. We've got lots of wind. We've got lots of tidal energy. We've got lots of waves off the coast of Cornwall. And we've got lots of sun. So we have all of the resources here. It's really our ability to be able to make use of them in time to help get the UK to net zero by 2050.
And Linda, I wonder if I could pose the same question. Is the Southwest ready for the net zero energy transition?
Yeah, I'd agree with what Peter said, to be honest. From my experience working in the industry, there's a lot of really skilled people, really knowledgeable people, some amazing innovators. The skills are definitely there, but whether there's enough people and whether it can be done quickly enough, that's where the question lies, isn't it?
So skills and time are a key concern, I guess, and something which we can cover later. But perhaps before we do, picture that it's 2050. We're in a slightly different age, albeit not too far from now. So Becky, assuming that you could start from scratch, what would our energy system look like in the future?
Well, it's worth noting that I think the first port of call, there'll be a lot more renewables on the grid. So we've already got solar, we've already got onshore wind, hopefully a lot more rollout of them in by 2050. Also, we're looking at floating offshore wind in the Celtic Sea in particular. That's going to be a big thing, I'd like to think, by 2050. But there's also looking at not so much generation assets, but electric vehicles, heat pumps, all of those sorts of things that we probably take for granted quite now, but we need to kind of think about it a bit more in the future. So that's probably where I'd go in terms of 2050, what it would look like. Just a lot more of a balanced system.
And presumably, Linda, these different technologies will touch people in one way or another. You'll see the electric vehicles, you'll see the wind turbines. So how do you think it will affect people's behaviours?
Yeah, well, I think that's the bit I'm most interested in, actually, is I'd love to see all those things, but I'd also really like to see that all people are involved in the energy system. So, for example, if there's a turbine being created near to a town or village, that the people who live in that place are actually directly benefiting from having the turbine on their doorstep. And similarly, we talk a lot about electricity, but actually heat is probably one of the main areas that needs addressing that doesn't get so much profile at the moment. And so what I'd love is that everybody everywhere in the Southwest was really aware of their energy needs, both heat and electricity, and that they were active players in where that came from, and that they were also managing their own demand in a way that beneficially affects all of us. And that's quite a complex thing, which I think for those of us who work in the industry, we can kind of see how our behaviour impacts grid or impacts how our homes work and our businesses and our travel. But that's a story that just needs to be so much more widely understood.
And Peter, we know from our work with the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership and the Southwest Vision 2050 that user outcomes are really, really important, aren't they? And so in terms of the energy transition, how do we better equip, how do we better ensure that we're meeting those user outcomes?
I think it's really important that the whole supply sector really looks at how it delivers things in terms of how customers see it. And that's not just about standards of service. It's also about education. I think one of the big things we found when we were doing the net zero route map, which we started off 3 years ago, was carbon literacy was a really, really important requirement in order to change behaviours. In other words, people had to understand what the problem was before you could even ask them to start solving it. It's not just about people, though. It's also about the industry and pricing mechanisms and so on. I mean, we have a rather bizarre thing at the moment that low carbon tariffs are put on electricity prices, but not on gas prices. And yet the electricity sector is rapidly decarbonizing, and the gas sector, for obvious reasons, is having a real challenge in being able to decarbonize. So I think it's that pricing signals are a big issue. Essentially, we need to get the subsidies off the electricity bills, because everything, a lot, particularly for the domestic consumer, will have to be provided by electricity in order to get to net zero. And the big question for consumers is, do they do that in their own house with solar panels or whatever? Do they do it as part of a community project, or do they rely on the sort of national delivery? And the reality is, in 2050, I think it'll be a blend of all three. I think some things will be nationally delivered. I think people will be doing as much as they can in their own home, and there will be areas where it's better for them to sort of join together as a community and either commission or support the development of renewables in their community.
So we know, as well as carbon literacy, that leadership is also really important, Peter. And I just wonder, Linda, is it down to people power? Is it down to those big corporations to really drive this forward? Is it going to take government policy? What's your view on that?
Oh, I think all of those things, isn't it, really? I think definitely people power. It's really inspiring if you're ever working with a community energy group, that the amount of energy and passion that comes from projects that are led by community members, you can't really match that with anything that would come from the corporate world. But having said that, the impact of some initiatives, like, I don't know if any of you are members of Octopus, but I took part in their energy saving sessions this year, and the outcome from those sessions was absolutely phenomenal. It saved something like 50% of National Grid's requirements for the peak demand. And obviously at a community level, you couldn't really hope to have that level of impact. Yeah, so I think definitely a mix of all.
And I suppose supply and demand are important aspects of this. So the supply in terms of those companies providing the energy and the actions that they're taking to support that transition, but also the way in which we use energy. And Becky, I wonder, will that have to change over time?
Yeah, that will have to change. As Linda brought up with the Octopus trial, it was very much consumers got paid to effectively turn their electricity off at a peak time. So I think we are going to have to be more considerate of actually when electricity is due to peak, particularly when people get home from work and cook food. So it might be that actually we have to spread that out a little bit. But also, when you're looking at bringing in things like electric vehicles, they offer the potential for storage, in which case you might then be able to actually keep electricity flowing without necessarily changing consumers' demand in terms of time.
Becky, aside from personal settings, so that's the household using energy for, I don't know, charging our iPhones or whatever it might be, I guess there's going to be a lot more pressure in industry as well. That's a commercial setting. So whether it's factories or manufacturers. And I wonder if renewables can really step up and fulfill that need.
Yeah, so you're right in the sense of the commercial industry is probably one of the largest polluters in regards to carbon dioxide. Renewables can play a part, but unfortunately, I think with the commercial sector, it's very much we have a 9-to-5 working day. And so whether the commercial sector itself can shift is slightly different. And so I think we have to look more along the lines of the generation technologies that are coming in. So renewables such as solar and wind, I think, are more than capable of providing for us. However, it's worth noting that they are flexible technologies. The sun's not always shining, the wind's not always blowing. And so it's a matter of ensuring that there is a large mix of these generation technologies that are able to provide the flexible services. We'll have things like nuclear, which can provide our baseline. They'll always be providing a set megawatt, etc. But yeah, the additional, the solar, the wind, even bringing on tidal, we have to make sure that there's enough to balance the whole system for when electricity is needed for that commercial sector.
And I think that's a really interesting point, because I've got a stat in front of me which says nuclear supplies something like 15% of our electricity at the moment. And of course, it can be used to ensure that we have that grid stability. That's making sure that the lights are constantly on. But it returns more than 100 times as much power as a solar site of the same size. And Peter, I just wonder, can renewables really compete?
Yes, they can. I think it's horses for courses, though. I think the big challenge for renewables is how do you fill in the gaps between their periods of generation? And that's particularly true when you get periods of high pressure in the winter months and the wind doesn't blow as a consequence, and you can get 5, 6, 7 days of no generation from wind. And therefore, it's a question of, it shouldn't just be looked at wind or solar or something else. It's actually wind and solar and all of the other technologies that are required then to play their part in creating the required energy resource that's needed to meet the demand. And I should just say at this point, it's probably worth mentioning that the demand in 2050 is going to be double what it is today, at least. And that's because the most economic form of providing heat is through electricity and, you know, open air source heat pumps and so on. So there is going to be quite a change, although, you know, energy efficiency will play a hugely important part. But I think I did some work 10 years ago where if you reduced today's demand by 25% through energy efficiency measures, you would still need to produce twice as much electricity in the future to meet the UK's energy needs.
So we talk about nuclear acting as perhaps a baseline, and we talk about our different energy mix, but I suppose we shouldn't also forget that we need to consider the security of our energy too. And Linda, I wonder, is it possible for the South West to support both a diverse and secure energy mix for the future?
Oh, that's an interesting question, because when you were talking about the wind not blowing, the sun not shining, I was immediately thinking about interconnect. There's a big project that's proposed, isn't there, in Morocco to bring a cable up from there where they would hopefully continue to have fairly stable solar. So does that address energy security? I guess it's about diversity, isn't it? So some of that could be addressed through interconnectors or projects in Morocco, for example. And some of it is we just need to look at all the different sources that we have within the UK. So, for example, the government's just announced funding for some innovative heat projects, including a deep geothermal project in Cornwall. So I guess that's also helpful, isn't it, in diversifying all our sources of energy. Yeah, looking at what's the potential of what we have on our own shores, coupled with what can others help us with.
And talking about shores and the use of water, Lerance in France is a 240 megawatt tidal barrage, which has been using since 1967, producing that sort of stability that we've been talking about. Becky, I wonder, does tidal have a future in the southwest?
I think it may, depending on which way you look at it. I think La Ranch is a very unique example of a tidal range project. So, for example, we're having a look at the tidal barrage across the Bristol Channel, and that kind of got shut down because of a number of factors. Financing, environmental issues are still one of them, particularly for tidal range. We have got a number of tidal lagoon proposals in Wales in particular. They're slightly smaller scale kind of tidal ranges. It's more of a wall comes out from an area and it effectively creates a tidal pool. So there's the potential for that. But I think unfortunately, particularly with tidal stream, which is different to range because it looks more of the flow of the current, you're looking at, in particular in Scotland at the moment, you need the larger tidal flow. So 2.5 metres per second in excess at spring tide, which is kind of its high peak. And unfortunately, bar the Bristol Channel, we just don't have that down here because of the lay of the land and the coastline. So if there is room for tidal down here, I think personally it'll be more smaller scale, whether it connects to small like mooring lines and boats, etc., to power them or shore power. I don't think it has a significant place at the southwest, but I'm sure that Peter will tell me otherwise.
And perhaps we'll come to Peter next. So, Peter, we know that one of the factors which has influenced tidal range technology is program, the environment and costs, certainly during that optioneering stage and consenting, but also in terms of driving down the interest which is accrued when we're financing those projects. So how do we overcome those challenges?
Well, the main issue, I think, with tidal range is that it's high capital cost and it's very difficult with the conventional financing system, that project financing, it's very difficult to be able to get that initial financing period to prove viable. Nuclear has exactly the same challenge. And we've all read about the Hinkley Point CFD negotiations and the challenges that they had even getting to their £92.50 per megawatt hour, which, you know, sort of 5 years ago, sounded very expensive. It sounds a lot less expensive nowadays, of course, but where the wholesale price has gone. And I think this is where we need to start looking at economics, energy economics, in a sort of slightly different way, because I think there is a premium that you can afford to pay for security of supply and certainly long-term security of cost. So I half agree with Becky in terms of tidal range, but I think the days of very large barrage, that's probably just going to be too challenging simply because of all the issues that that brings up. I mean, they're very big capital cost projects. They are a barrier to anything that's wanting to pass up and down the estuary. And that's really where tidal lagoons emerged from. In one of the studies we did back in 2008, 2009 for government, we looked at the concept of barrages versus lagoons, and Bridgewater Bay Lagoon came up very favourably then. And so I think large-scale lagoons are, I think, going to be in the Severn estuary by 2050. And there could be on both the English and the Welsh sides, but you can't overdevelop, because as soon as you overdevelop, you get the cumulative effects, which means that you build one after another, and the second one will take energy away from the first one simply because they all affect the hydrodynamic environment. There are big environmental issues, though. Interestingly enough, RSPB and others, we did quite a bit of work with them 10 years ago, looking at how you could achieve tidal energy whilst at the same time achieving an environmental benefit. And of course, under the latest planning regulations, every project which has an impact above the mean low water spring tide level has to achieve a 10% biodiversity gain. So I think, if you like, the environmental issues are going to be baked in to any future tidal range solution. And they certainly can be. There are opportunities. The difficulty with both tidal stream and tidal range is that you need to have very large projects in order to make them economically viable. Very difficult to do, if not impossible to do, at a micro level. Severn Estuary, although it's got a very big tidal range, only has a couple of sweet spots for tidal stream, so that you can't really put in a lot of capacity in the Severn for tidal stream. And that means that the infrastructure you require, you know, all the cables and so on to go and service it, becomes a much bigger component of the cost. So there are swings and roundabouts. Lagoons are likely to go forward, but probably no more than two or three of differing sizes. It'd probably be that one, a smaller one, goes first, simply to provide investor confidence. But interesting point on La Ronde, it's been operating now for, you know, over 60 years. It's had only maintenance undertaken to it. The turbines were refurbished. They weren't replaced. The control system is the only thing that's actually been replaced. EDF now use it for a variety of different things, not only to produce low carbon energy at low cost, they also use it to regulate the grid as well. So it can act as a sort of a battery storage element as well. And so I think, you know, it's very dangerous to look at these things in simplistic terms. They're a bit more complex. And of course, when La Ronde was first built, it was the most expensive form of energy on the EDF system. And the EDF system has a number of nuclear power generators there. It's now the cheapest form. And it's got another 60, 70 years of life left in it. And that means that it's the only form of electricity where future generations will be paying less.
We've just run out of tape, Peter, so we'll have to put a new one in the system after that, I think. But I knew I shouldn't have started on tidal. An informed view, but very interesting. Thank you.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest.
I suppose what we shouldn't discount, though, at the minute, of course, the buzzword is flow. And I wonder, Linda, if you could just explain what flow really means, what it stands for.
I don't actually really know why everyone insists on calling it flow, because it's just offshore wind, which seems to me quite a short enough name. I think we should just go with that.
And in terms of delivering floating offshore wind, how different is it to delivering onshore wind turbines?
Well, it's a new sector in the UK, so I think that's the challenge, isn't it? That there's a whole load of skills, infrastructure requirements just to undertake the construction. And then not only that, but you're going to have to connect your turbines to the land. Otherwise, the electricity's not going to go anywhere, is it? Yeah, so it's a big challenge. But I think there's strong commitment, isn't there, to developing offshore wind. So I'm very confident that that's going to happen, and it's going to happen soon.
So we've spoken about tidal range and we've touched on floating offshore wind. We should, of course, mention hydrogen, but perhaps we'll come back to that one. We've got all these different types of technologies. And of course, the UK government has huge aspirations to meet them. For wind alone, I think it's something like 50 gigawatts of energy by 2030. But I wonder, Becky, is the grid, and when I say the grid, I mean our energy system, electricity network, is it ready in the southwest to meet those demands?
I would unfortunately have to say no, both from a transmission and distribution sense. So transmission-wise, so greater than 400 kilovolts, or that's where your kind of generation technologies will come in, we only have very few grid supply points down this end, all of which probably need to be upgraded in order to take extra capacity in. And the distribution network is a lot more complicated in terms of voltage and spreading the capacity around and allowing consumers to take the power off it. So again, a lot of the grid in the whole of the nation will need to be upgraded. In particular, yeah, the southwest, especially when looking at floating offshore wind that's planning to come up the Celtic Sea. The Crown Estate have announced 4 gigawatts to come up by 2030. At this moment in time, there is nowhere for that to come in the southwest. They're looking at Wales and Pembroke in particular, the X-Links interconnectors coming into Alva Discox and kind of North Devon. So that's allegedly full. So there's kind of nowhere for this power to go at the moment. It needs to be upgraded, unfortunately.
So we've clearly got some challenges around grid connection in the region, but we shouldn't lose sight of that wider picture, supply across the peninsula. Clearly, we're a rural destination. And of course, we're reliant on things like oil for heating. And that's all related to the different infrastructure that we have in place. And Peter, I wonder, how will we transition as quite a rural population to these low carbon technologies?
Well, it's going to be more cables, because that's what's going to be required at the moment, as you say, with oil being used for heating in large part of the peninsula. They don't have any electricity cables going to their connections for heating. So if you look at the overall picture where the UK has to double its electricity supply in order to meet demand by 2050, because we're electrifying transport and heat, that's probably going to be a much higher factor in the southwest, where we're probably going to be between 2 and 3 times as many electricity cables as we have at the moment. So how that's going to be achieved is a big question. You know, are these overground? Are these underground? What happens with heating of these cables if you are putting in lower voltages but higher currents? You know, there are some significant challenges, I think, in terms of getting to this transition. You've got all the EV network as well, you know, which is going to just exacerbate the issue. Possible solution, how can you combine the EV infrastructure with the domestic charging infrastructure? That could be a clever solution. I think we will need clever solutions. National Grid produced their future energy scenarios, and interestingly, they are looking at 4 different scenarios. And even the one that doesn't achieve net zero by 2050 sort of shows almost double the electricity demand. So I think we will find that it's going to be very difficult. Could community heating solve some of this in the southwest? We've got a lot of mines in the Cornish area. Could we use those mines as heat sources for district heating? That's a possibility. Less of an option in Devon, I think, or Somerset, but they are using it in Bristol with their heat networks there. They're taking water from the river and using that as a heat source. So there are solutions. They're just perhaps not the conventional solutions that everyone's been used to.
Brilliant. Thank you, Peter. So clearly the supply as much as the distribution is an issue for us. And on that point about distribution, clearly getting power to and from people is going to be really challenging. It means more cables. And Linda, I wonder if we are seeing more pylons and so on in the countryside, How do you think people are going to react? And how do we include communities in that decision making?
Yeah, it's a really good point, actually, isn't it? I think it's easy to think about local community generation tied with local community use. But when you talk about national level infrastructure, that's a totally different story, because it is to an extent something that is just going to be imposed on them. It's not going to be sort of democratic, as it were. It's just where it needs to go. I think a lot of it comes down to messaging. It's something we've been thinking really carefully about recently, that the energy system is so complex. And I think even for people who work in the industry, there's no way you could really understand it all. So for people who don't work in our industry, what chance do they really have? So I think there's a really important role for those of us who are in the know, to an extent, to find ways of actually communicating that really simply. So that's something we've been putting a lot of thought to recently, is like taking up a leadership role, really, and saying, what do people need to know? Because we all have to move through to 2050 together. You can't just have a small group of people trying to plough on forwards. Everyone needs to understand what's going on. Yeah, so I think communication, in short, and that can't just come from government. I think that's what I'm thinking about, is you need industry leaders to be speaking out in a clear way, and as we're trying to do today, avoid using jargon and just explain it simply, because it's not impossible to understand. It's just not a topic that's traditionally been talked about. Yeah, so I think it's becoming more so. And although it's not nice to say that the energy crisis has a positive, it sort of does, because it's made it so topical that actually I'm having conversations with neighbours and colleagues and friends about subjects there's no way would have come up even a handful of years ago. And I've been able to explain to them why a heat pump's a good thing, or why driving an EV is actually okay when they've heard so much negativity about lithium. Or there's just so many topics, aren't there, that you can address just through bringing those to the table.
Is it fair to say that education is a really important part of this, do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely important. It's just sometimes using the word education can kind of imply like that we need to put it into a curriculum somewhere, or that there needs to be some kind of official mandate for it. Whereas I think it's a lot more complex, and I think there's a role for media, and there's a role, for example, the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership is the perfect vessel for this kind of conversation, because it goes in through so many industries. It's not just keeping it contained within our one silo of energy infrastructure. Let's just focus on energy infrastructure. No, it's not. It actually affects everything, doesn't it? Everything that we do every day. And yeah, I'm not sure exactly what the answer is, but for those of us who have the opportunity of sharing that knowledge, then I think we just have to step up and do that.
While we're talking about education, I wonder if we could also talk about skills. We've heard the term green skills quite a lot recently. It seems to be the buzzword at the minute. And of course, that's linking to renewables and a new generation of individuals with skills equipped to bring us forward into that net zero revolution. I read a stat the other day and it said something like 59,000 engineering graduates and technicians are currently lacking in the sector. And only 47% of 11 to 16 year olds really know what civil engineers do. So I wonder if I could go around the table and ask you each how we can change that. Linda, I'll start with you.
Wow, that's a big question, isn't it? I suppose from the focus that we're looking at the moment in terms of skills is around decarbonisation of buildings. So it's not necessarily civil engineer graduates, it's technicians, it's people at all levels who will need to either train or retrain or transition within their current roles to just doing something slightly different. So the optimistic side of me thinks the people are there, they just need to know where it is they need to move to, I guess. And certainly from what I've seen, a lot of the councils, combined authorities and so on are looking at the challenge of skills and how can we make sure that our colleges are providing the training that's required to move people into these new sectors.
Thanks, Linda. So evolution rather than revolution.
I think there is an element of revolution, but yes, evolution as well.
Becky, how do we make a career in infrastructure and in the energy transition more appealing?
There are two ways of looking at this. You've got from an apprentice level upwards, sort of really training them, or you've got retraining people that are already in the industry. And I think a similar approach can be applied to both of them. I think it's worth noting that in particular, a lot of the skills that are needed in this industry, I saw a stat that about 88% of them are transferable across anything, whether you want to create a solar farm or look at heat pumps. 80% of those skills are common between the two, and then it's the 20% that are really particular to the technology. And so I think it's worth highlighting that actually, if you go down a particular route, you're not just stuck on that route. You can actually retrain and upskill to work on all of these technologies. And I think it's really highlighting that for the people.
And Peter, we're lacking individuals with the sorts of skills we've been discussing today, those green skills. What's your view on how we change that?
Engineering is exciting. I mean, that's the point. Everyone I've known who's gone into engineering has been absolutely enthralled by it. And that includes non-engineers who've then become engineers, so geography graduates and so on. So anyone with an interest in how we make the modern world work, I think, would really benefit from a career in engineering. But I don't think half of them recognise that as yet. And that's one of the challenges. On the other points, it's not just about degrees. It's about apprenticeships. It's about training on the job. You know, we've got a lot of gas fitters at the moment who, if net zero goes according to plan, will not be going out and servicing gas boilers in 20 years time. So my view would be we do a dual approach where they carry on servicing gas boilers, but they also learn how to service heat pumps, which are completely different technology and very much more challenging. I think in these early years will become more and more mainstream as more heat pumps are installed. But bottom line, we've got to get our enthusiasm for engineering out there in the real world and infuse others so that they want to come and do this, pursue this career course in developing our infrastructure. I mean, it's so fundamental. Absolutely everything depends on it, our public health, our quality of life, our economic progress. So it's an absolutely fundamental piece of how the UK operates. And we just got to make everyone wants to contribute to that part of it.
You mentioned, Peter, about the diversity element, and that really strikes me about our industry, that it's so complex that the only way you can resolve that is with the diversity of thought. So for me, it's essential that we diversify the people who are involved with that.
And I guess that goes beyond race and gender and so on, doesn't it? It's bringing different people to the table. I mean, something that I've done at work now is bring in less experienced graduates, apprentices, so on, just because they have completely different trains of thought. And I'm sure you'll all agree is actually that can be a real eye-opener, looking at a challenge from a completely fresh perspective. Now, there's one last question I have, a burning question, and it relates to the UK government's aspirations for jet zero and green ships. And the reason I ask, of course, is because we have the UK's only spaceport in the region. And, of course, because actually that transition is so reliant on our different infrastructures, ports, harbours, airports, so on and so forth. So, Peter, how can, as the South West, we support those different industries? And is jet zero and green ships, are they really attainable?
Green ships certainly are. And I think, you know, the shipping movement are making progress in that area. In aviation, there's a lot of work going on in terms of how to decarbonize aviation. Whether the answer will be the jet zero solution, which is sort of ammonia and hydrogen, or whether it will be something else. I mean, there has been a trial going on between Exeter and Newquay on electric planes with the idea of bringing in an electric commuter service via plane. You know, whether that takes us down another avenue, I think that could be interesting. I think getting heavy aviation decarbonised is a real challenge, and we should probably be focusing on those easier to decarbonise areas first and let the clever guys at Rolls-Royce and other organisations in the aviation sector give them a bit of time to come up with a good solution rather than a quick solution.
In regard to green shipping, particularly with floating offshore wind coming out, project developers have to demonstrate that the actual processes that they go through in terms of operations and maintenance and also transferring the structures out there, they are decarbonised as much as possible. And so green shipping is obviously quite key for that. And the South West, I think, is very well placed in order to help that. We've got the universities of Plymouth and Exeter, including the campus at Falmouth, all of which are really key on and prime position to progress kind of clean maritime. I think they have clean maritime hubs in Exeter. The University of Plymouth has the Smart Sound for autonomous vessels. I think the research institutes are well placed. And then also our ports will play a large part of that as well. So Appledore have the Clean Maritime Innovation Centre, which has just been given 15.6 million to look into this sort of stuff. We've also got Port of Talbot and the Port of Milford Haven are both looking at the port requirements to facilitate these larger low carbon vessels. At the moment, whether those vessels will be hydrogen or ammonia, I don't think is overly certain, but they're definitely coming. And I think the Southwest is definitely well placed to facilitate that movement.
So we've heard in recent years different policies come out from government in terms of net zero, energy security, But what policy or legislation change would really help the South West in its energy transition? Let's start with Linda.
Well, as you say, there has been an awful lot of policy, legislation, consultations and so on that's been happening recently. I think the key is that we really need to leverage in private finance to really transition as quickly and at a pace and scale that we need to do. And so the best thing that could be put in place is just having long-term certainty. And we've seen how positive that's been in terms of electric vehicle transition, that now that there's such a clear picture, all of the manufacturers, all of the charge point operators and so on have massive confidence in that sector, and the scale of investment is really coming to play.
Okay, Becky, and what are your thoughts?
Peter alluded to one earlier on about the difficulties in onshore wind planning. So I think that's a key one that needs to change straight away. And then the next one is in terms of contracts for difference. So this is a government mechanism which effectively helps drive down the prices for developers. And ultimately, that results in consumer savings for renewable technologies. At the moment, it's focused solely on driving costs down. But it's difficult, in particular for newer technologies like floating offshore wind and tidal, to then build infrastructure around these assets that if focused purely on driving costs down, the supply chain just isn't able to handle that at the moment. There is a current consultation out at the moment looking at non-price criteria to the contract for difference. So that could be supply chain, that's balancing, it could be whole system support, community benefits. But I think that particular mechanism needs to include other factors as opposed to just driving down costs.
And Peter, what policy changes would you see helping the energy transition in the South West?
Policy number one, don't have so many policies that sort of change over 6 to 12 months. It's really important, I think, that the sector sees stability. That improves investor confidence. The other area, I think, which needs revisiting, Becky has talked about it, which was the contracts for difference regime. But I think it needs to go wider than that. I think at the moment we have two major mechanisms, capacity mechanism and the contract for difference mechanism, which is for low carbon. There are some generating technologies that need to access both of those, but they can't. And so therefore, it's a suboptimal arrangement. It benefits wind and solar in terms of CFD and capacity mechanisms. It benefits storage media like batteries that we're going to be seeing more and more of. But we just need, I think, a rethink of a strategy, because to get to 2050, we can't just be tinkering with the existing system. We've actually got to modify it quite significantly and make it fit for purpose. And that affects everything from the grid through to getting generating stations built and how our consumers use electricity.
Thank you to all of my guests today, Becky, Linda and Peter. And that brings our podcast on energy infrastructure to an end. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn. Follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.